No. Good afternoon, and really delighted to have you guys here. This is a select group, and we're going to focus on actually any questions having to do with your practice or having to do with what we've studied so far. So, we're taking practice questions. And when I say about your practice, I mean essentially about your practice as it connects to our study. I know for me, reading your incredibly beautiful posts and also experiencing what it's been like for me, being present on the call and preparing for the call and interfacing with you guys during the week, I'm just reminded again and again and again of where and why I love this text so much, because it just does seem to have such a powerful immediate effect on the experience of separation and unity, on the way we look at our lives and each other. And interestingly enough, this weekend I was in the Bay Area, and I stopped by the Oakland City Yoga Ashram, which was the first place I ever studied the Paratiyabhijna Hridayam. And it turned out that the room where we used to gather, five of us who initially studied it together with an Indian teacher who was pretty much learning as he went along. So although he was really very good at it, he was just a little bit ahead of us. And over the years, you know, we all got deeper and deeper into the text. So I actually went to the room where I first studied the Paratiyabhijna Hridayam and sat there. It's now a meditation room, and felt the grace of this transmission and of the lineages that have put their shakti behind giving students like us, really century after century, a window into the truth of ourselves. So very, very welcome to all of you. And we're going to chant the Namashivaya Sakta Tam Mantras, and then we're just going to plunge into any questions you have. The maximum length of the call is going to be an hour, but if we run out of questions, or you know, anyone has, there's nothing else to ask or tell, we'll end if that becomes apparent. But so let's find a comfortable posture, find a posture that's fairly upright, and we'll just center ourselves through the central channel, feeling the weight of the sit bones against the seat. If you're taking a walk and listening, ground yourself through your feet. Just feel your feet spreading to literally feel supported by the earth, feel the power of the earth. And then with the breath, inhaling down towards the base, exhaling up towards the heart. Bring your awareness into the heart, and we'll chant Namah Shivaya Sat Tam 3 times. Om Namah Shivaya Sat Tam Panchakritya Vidayine Chidananda Gana Svatma Paramartha Vabhasine Namah Shivaya Sat Tam Panchakritya Vidayine Chidananda Garna Svatma Paramartava Basine Namah Shivaya Satatam Panchakritya Vidayine Chidananda Garna Svatma Paramartava Basine And we'll just take a couple of minutes to drop this mantra Namah Shivaya into the heart with the inhalation. And with the exhalation, just allow yourself to be present in the heart. We'll just center ourselves with Namah Shivaya. I bow to, I become one with that great underlying light of consciousness, the great Prakasha, whose power of self-reflection is that incomparable Chitti Shakti, the power of awareness and bliss, whose creative activity is our experience of a material world and the inner world. So just a moment of inhaling Namah Shivaya, exhaling with the feeling of the energy of that mantra spreading through the body. And you can take a deep breath in and exhale. Open your eyes if you feel like it. And we'll take our first question. Deb is monitoring us, and you can raise your hand, press star 2. Deb, you want to give us the instructions? Thank you.
Yeah. If you want to ask a question, just hit star 2 and that'll raise your hand. And I will call out what city I can see. Sometimes it'll give me a name, but usually it's a city, so you'll just have to see if you can speak because I will have to unmute you. I'm going to go ahead and Sally, we have a couple of questions already on the list from our webcast people, so maybe we can address those real quickly. First one, Shirley asks, what does our password for the student area, Upadesa? And I'm terrible on my pronunciation. She's wondering what it means.
Tell me the password again.
So it's UPADESA. Upadesa.
Upadesha. Upadesha. Yes. So Upadesha literally means instruction, teaching, and it's the instruction that comes from the mouth of the teacher, the physical teacher, in this case me, but in a deeper sense, the instruction that comes from the mouth of the infinite as that, you know, the teachings of the truth are revealed. The Upanishads are called Upanishads because there's a congruity between the first syllable Upa and in Upanishad and Upa in Upadesha. And the Upa means nearness. So the Upadesha is the teaching you receive being near the teacher, as opposed to the teaching you receive from a text. That is, the Upadesha means verbal instruction, includes verbal instruction. Thank you for asking that question.
And I will tell everybody that normally the passwords. I just pick, I've looked through text and material in preparation for Sally's stuff, and I just pick a word that I think will work. So it's kind of odd that I picked that word.
Well, I think it's,
I didn't
I
know the meaning.
Your passwords are always very appropriate, so your example of your double attunement, even if you don't know.
So we also had someone is asking about what the translation of the starting mantra is.
Okay. I believe that's on your chant sheet, but
which I don't have
in front of me, but I'm going to give you my down and dirty translation. It is Namah Shivaya, I bow to the great light of consciousness. Satatam, who eternally performs the fivefold functions. Remember, manifestation, sustenance or maintenance, dissolution, concealing his or her true nature, and then revealing herself, revealing himself through the fifth process of grace. Whose nature is Chidananda Gana, meaning, I love this word, a mass of awareness and bliss, and who is the revealer of the highest knowledge. So the great light of consciousness in its function as teacher, as giver of knowledge. So thank you again for that. Great question.
Yeah. And we have one more. And this is from Laurel. She's asking, she'd love to hear more about the artistic creation of universe / multiverse. Anything else to read or poetry or the pleasure of your voice? Is there a particular mantra that deepens this knowing, this ability, this gift?
Well, Laurel, speaking as an artist, asking this question as an artist, yes, there are actually many verses here and there in the Shaiva texts, and I promise that I will do a little bit of research and give you some quotes, because generally speaking, the passages that express this are scattered here and there among the Shaiva texts, and we get to receive them mostly through the work of scholars who have translated these random verses, because many of the original texts that they come from have not been translated and are not available. So the teaching of the artistic quality of the universe is it's the very basis of the teaching of how the universe is created. In other words, very core, very key to the understanding of reality in, I would say, all through the Indian tradition, is that the universe is created for play, for sport. You know, my guru's spiritual autobiography was called Chit Shakti Vilas, which literally means the play of Chitti Shakti. But this is one of my favorite verses about it, from a great sage called Utpaladeva. He says, God, consciousness, in essence, like a magician, makes the whole ensemble of things which reside in him appear outside himself without using any external cause, purely by the power of his will. And this understanding is the core of the recognition of the manifestation or creativity as a kind of creative surge of power of art, really. So it's one of the core teachings of Trika, of the Pratyabhignatradayam. It's also in many other traditions. In Buddhism also, that's often said that this universe is a magic show. It's a piece of theater. It's a play. The The analogy most often used is that of a play or a performance. And if you remember in the one of the translations of the first verse, we say that Chitti Shakti is the cause of the performance of the universe. So that's a brief look at it. And as I said, I'll put that in your, I'll put some quotes in the homework so that you can look for it. But the deep understanding of Chitti Shakti that we talked about in the first week is that because whatever appears as the universe is actually manifesting inside Chitti, inside the self-reflective, creative, dynamic aspect of this transcendent supreme being. And if you remember, I believe we looked at this last week, Shakti, out in her own bliss, rises up as the impulse to create. There's a late tantric text called Maharta Manjari, which if you can find a translation of it, is one of the most beautiful texts there is. It's very poetic. It's all about the creation as a work of art, as a work that arises out of bliss. And I think you may find, I certainly find, and many of you who are artistically creative or who identify yourselves as artists, as creators in a very specific way, know how a creation arises seemingly from, often it feels as though it was always there but never expressed. Sometimes I know in my own creative experience, very often because I write, the thing that I often think that wants to be produced on the page often feels as though it's coming through my fingers. That is, it's not coming through my mind. It's literally just coming onto the page as though something inside my consciousness is expressing itself without any mediation from my mental apparatus. And then, of course, the mind comes in and edits it and critiques it and all those, makes it better, all those things. But I would say that initial surge of creativity is what is behind the manifestation of this universe. Thank you.
Okay, and Shirley actually was asking about, she corrected and said she meant the beautiful song that starts off our classes, what the translation
Oh my God. Yes, I'm actually going to have to get the text because I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
But it's a prayer to the goddess. And it's part of the tradition of a tradition that clusters around the goddess Lalita. It's a piece of, or some of it being sung there, is a piece of the Lalita Sahasranama, which is a text called, that translates as the Thousand Names of Lalita. And it actually goes through various names that are given to the goddess, addressing the goddess as, and again, I don't have the text in front of me, but as you whose body is red like the, like a hibiscus flower, you who dwells in the garden of bliss, you who is supremely auspicious, I bow to you. So there are traditionally 1,000 names of the goddess that are sung in that particular text. And there's another text which I practice regularly called the Lalita Trishati, which has similarly is essentially an invocation to the goddess under many, many names, descriptors. I can find you guys a translation and we can send it out.
Okay. All right, we got our first question from our callers, and I'm unmuting, and we have no name or city, so if you raised your hand, go ahead and speak up.
Hi, Sally. This is Lauren Palmer from Somerville, Massachusetts.
All right.
Thank you for doing this extra question-answer period. I feel honored to be in your presence.
Well, we are honored to
My question. Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. Your question.
My question, similar to the question that I had after going through the Goddess Course into the Bhagavad Gita, and now that I am really steeped in the Bhagavad Gita and the Krishna mantra, Om Namo Narayanaya, I am presented with a new mantra.
Yeah,
it's like, maybe the Hindus are able to keep this all sorted out, but
Let me interrupt.
Yeah.
If you are deeply into the Om Namo Narayanaya mantra, just continue doing that. I generally, when I'm teaching a class, as you know, I try to offer a mantra that's unique to that aspect of the tradition, because when you practice that mantra, it's going to help you feel closer to the tradition. But the truth is that all mantras, as we were talking about last week, all mantras come from the mantreshwaras, you know, and in fact, in the case of these mantras from the Maha Mantreshwaras, these mantras like Om Namo Narayanaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Saha, Soham, these are mantras that, according to the tradition, exist as, and I know you have this experience, Lauren, they exist as powers in higher realms, in higher states of consciousness. And when they're activated for us in a situation like this and then practiced, they begin to open up our access to that realm, which, again, as we have been saying, is not elsewhere. It's in us. So I want to say this to everybody. If there's a mantra that you're feeling very, very connected to, that mantra is going to probably come up on its own, Lauren. Does that happen? You know, if you try to do Salha, you end up saying Om Namo Narayanaya.
Yeah.
Yeah. So absolutely stay with the mantra that you've been practicing. There are practices that we do, especially in tantric traditions, that are very specifically directed by a mantra. So in that case, the mantra you practice is very, very important for enlivening your connection to the deity. In this case, because what we are talking about is not deity in any we're not practicing this mantra in order to attain a particular set of powers or gifts from the divine. We're practicing the mantra in order to tune ourselves to the highest level of awareness that we are capable of attuning ourselves to at any time. And the truth is, Narayan, Krishna, Vishnu, though they have a slightly different flavor than the Shiva Shakti flavor, as you know from studying the Bhagavad Gita, basically it comes down to the same absolutely non-dual teaching. So you can fully feel happy and confident to do that mantra, and just don't feel like you have to work with Saha. And if you feel drawn to practicing with it while you're in class, that's great. But don't feel like you have to change mantras. In fact, not necessarily a great idea to change mantras if you're very, 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 the word that's coming up is invested, but that you're very deeply into a mantra that's taking root in you. So again, thank you for that question.
Thank you, Sally. May you continue to thrive and to teach us. May you have long life. Thank you.
And you too, Lauren. Big love.
Okay, we have our next one.
Yes.
Go ahead. If you've raised your hand, go ahead and speak up. I think it's maybe a Kavita?
I think it's Kavita.
Kavita?
I see. Is it Kavita?
Hi, Sally.
Hi, Kavita. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, thank you. It's so good to talk with you. And this course is so magnificent. I've never heard a more clearer description of the tattvas. It was just so beautiful. Thank you so much.
Oh, my honor. I'm so great to get to talk about the tattvas.
Yeah. So I had a question, and I come from a long, investment, so to speak, in Advaita Vedanta, and understand, some of the fundamental differences, of course, between Shaiva Tantra and Vedanta, primarily being this the very first verse, which is that of creation. Because in Advaita, we have, the notion of Brahman and Ishvara, which are very separate. Brahman being the one that does nothing, has no doing functions. And here, Shiva Shakti, Chitti Shakti is the creator. So there is that fundamental difference. But when looking at the tattva chart, trying to understand that, there is a purusha,
yes,
which comes after the maya. Now, could you explain, where purusha, Brahman, Shiva, a little bit of that, just for clarity for me?
Yes. Is there more to the question?
No, that that was the main question in terms of, are we saying that Brahman, because Brahman does not do anything, and the same thing with Purusha, because I understood from your beautiful talk that Purusha is Shiva cut off from his powers to act and act,
yes,
purely as a witness, and that seems a lot like Brahman.
Yes, except that, yes, but the Brahman in, at least as Brahman is one of the most widely used names of the transcendent absolute awareness in the Indian tradition. And I honestly, if you look at the tattva chart, I'm pretty sure that it has Paramashiva at the very top.
Yeah.
And Paramashiva, Paramashakti, they're really, totally intertwined. That's where Brahma lives.
Yeah.
So Paramashiva and Brahman are, at least in the Shaiva system, considered different names for the same transcendent, utterly non-dual consciousness, but there's a difference in how they're described. And again, because I'm speaking from the tradition, I'm going to give you what the tradition says about this. The Kashmir Shaivism, Trika, basically considers itself the advanced course. So,
yeah.
And now, and in Advaita, of course, there's the sort of preliminary experience of the world is unreal, only Brahman is real, only consciousness is real. And then, as you know, once the seeker has gotten it, then there's the recognition that the world itself is Brahman. And so my own feeling is that the second line of Shankara's famous aphoristic statement actually contains the teaching that Kashmir Shaivism, that Trika, that Nandol Shaiva Tantra will go on to elucidate and to really open up, which is that actually the divine is completely infused, completely immanent in the world. And the thing is that what the Shaivas always say about the Advaita Vedantins is that they have this problem because they insist that, that the Supreme Consciousness doesn't act, that it's purely a witness, that it's completely detached from the world.
We just momentarily lost Sally, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh,
no,
there
I'm
we
here.
Go.
Oh, okay. Okay, are we good?
Yeah, I can hear you again. We've kind of lost you.
So what did you, where did you lose me? What was the last thing I said?
About, you know, the Kashmir Shaivism, the sages will say that that's where Brahman doesn't do anything.
Right. So what the Shaiva sages say, and it's actually in Sutra 7 of the Prasibhignatrindam, Kshema Raja, you know, as you know, the tradition in spirit religious scholarship in every tradition, and certainly in India, is that scholars and practitioners argue over who's right about, you know, what is God. We know what God is. You guys just have a partial or unenlightened view. So in the spiritual one-upmanship of Trika, they say that the Advaitins have this problem of having to account for the manifestation of the universe. And since they don't allow Brahman to have any Shakti, they have to bring in this power of Maya, which is said to be, you know, either not really Brahman, not really existing, but somehow existing. And in Trika, they just take care of the problem by seeing the divine as intrinsically creative. And it's a departure.
Yeah.
In the non-dual tradition. So it's a kind of a radical departure from the Advaita view.
Yeah.
So, and then Ishwara who in Advaita is kind of the active part of Brahman, right, who sort of arises at a later stage. The view of Ishwara in Shaivism is not that different, in that Ishwara in Shaivism is seen as personal divinity with, you know, with the powers that we associate with the divine, but at a slightly more manifest stage of consciousness. And if you, in the esoteric descriptions of the tattvas, which I didn't give you because it's, you know, it, for someone who's not a geek, which I know you are, but some of us are not geeks, but. So, but there's in this moment when Shakti raises her head and has the idea, oh, universe, you know, I want to become many, you know, I am one, let me become many. There's this moment when she draws the first veil between herself and her inseparable, you know, awareness consort self. So in that moment when there's this tiny little separation between Shiva and Shakti, and this happens right before Sadashiva Tattva, I thought, mm-hmm. I told you this is a geek point. It's like, that's an experience of void, absolute void. And in general, Brahman is that actionless Brahman is associated with that void state.
Ah, I
so
see.
So it's okay. He's transcendent, but he's not acting because Shakti has cut him off in that very moment in order to, so to speak. And again, I like to see this in kind of gender terms because it's more fun.
Yes.
So it's sort of like, it's like Shiva and Shakti are in this, you know, enormous cosmic embrace, and Shakti gets an idea, and therefore she extricates herself from the embrace for a moment in order to, you know, to start doing her, in order to make the painting, in order to, you know, make the play. And Shiva, Brahman, is still transcendent, still ecstatic, but, you know, essentially is in a passive position, but this is at a much higher level of consciousness than Purusha.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I said in the discussion, which we're going to come to again and again and again, is that the aham, you know, is the sense of self in this tradition exists at three levels. So the I at the level of Paramashiva, Shiva Shakti, that for, you know, the first five tattvas, is it recognizes that it encompasses everything. You know, that there's nothing outside it. So it's the Shiva's Shakti's Brahman's great I-ness. Then when the contraction happens and the I is you know, very strongly separated from the this, Shiva is very strongly separated from Shakti and becomes Purusha, then all the powers of the self are temporarily removed and then given back by Prakriti. And then when we experience ourselves as the I who identifies as Sally or Kavita at the level of a Ahamkara Tattva, which is Tattva 16, you know, way, way down the Tattva chart, way less, way more contracted. And I have found over the years that you can sort of tell where you're at in terms of your expansion or the expansion or contraction of your consciousness by what aspect of the I you're identifying with. So when you're identifying with pure consciousness in a meditative state and yet have no sense of the, you know, of the vastness of the capacities that are inside you, then you're in Purusha. If you're identifying with the I that is Brahman, I mean, if you're actually doing I am Shiva or Tatvamasi or I am Aham Brahmasmi, that's, you're in a very, very much more, let's call it empowered state. Yeah. So the Shaivites basically say that Advaitins are wrong about Brahman. He's not actionless. He's full of Shakti. So we can, you know, make our own decisions
so,
about who we believe.
Yeah.
Yes,
so
go on.
You know, just now what you said about, you know, knowing where one is based on our practice and experience. So the understanding of I am Purusha, that would be Atmavyapti, right? And
yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. I believe so.
Okay.
I believe that is the experience of Atmavyapti. There's another way of looking at it, which is that Shuddhavidya Tattva, the Tattva Abhya above Maya,
yeah,
is the experience of Atmavyapti. Atmavyapti, guys, means the pervasion of the self. So, and in Shuddhavidya Tattva, it's the stage right before Maya, where the entire experience, the entire recognition of a cosmos, is seen to be full, complete, and yet inside the self, and there's a complete balance between the sense of self and the sense of world. And this is often said to be the initial experience of a Shaivite awakening. That is, because a Shaivite awakening always contains a world, right? So, yeah. So there's a sense that your self pervades the creation or the manifestation, and you may have had that experience. It's an experience I have quite a lot of, you know, of feeling, you know, often, usually with my eyes open, where I actually am experiencing the world I see as being inside me. You know, so if somebody is walking and I'm in that state, it feels like they're walking inside my awareness. And that's Atmavyapti, right? Your consciousness pervades whatever you're experiencing. And it's an awake state that includes a sense of universe. So it's probably in Shuddhavidya Tattva rather than Purusha Tattva. Purusha Tattva, again, in my experience, is that witness conscious state where there's not necessarily any sense of world. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. That makes so much sense. And then the Shiva Vyapti, of course, is the Paramashiva.
Exactly. It's not only that the world is inside you, and not only that the world is part of your body, but the world is your creation. You know, you have ultimate power in that creation.
Okay.
So and Shaiva, you know, one of the big differences between the Advaita non-dual view and the Tantric non-dual view is that in the Tantric non-dual view, the higher you go, the more empowered you become. And they don't really believe that you're fully enlightened until you have recognized that not only is the world within you, not only is your consciousness one with the absolute, it also empowered, you know, so that in my tradition, which is a tradition that really celebrates a particular kind of enlightened or awake being that called Siddhas, and of course the Tibetan tradition has the same understanding, one of the qualities that marks a Siddha, a perfected practitioner in this tradition, is that they do have the power to make a huge, to actually change physical reality. So, and all those hagiographic stories that we read about, saints and sages who can keep your plane from crashing, or who can, manifest not minor siddhis, but major siddhis, like you say to your guru, change my life, and your guru can change your life in whatever way is appropriate and necessary. So the presence of powers, of those powers, is considered an important marker of achievement in the Shaiva Tantra. And of course, we all know that that understanding has led to a lot of misunderstanding about people with psychic powers being enlightened. So there's it's not a teaching that it's a teaching that needs to be understood very deeply, so that you're not confusing an enlightened siddha with somebody who happens to be clairvoyant, and can look into your eyes and read your future. We're talking about major capacities to change the nature of reality. And, in so many of the traditions, you can read about this in Yogananda Paramahamsa's autobiography. So the tradition that there are these great masters who live in the Himalayas or who live in higher worlds, whose cosmic job is protecting the cosmos, and we sort of say these are the beings who are going to keep, our nuclear weapons from blowing us up. That's the level of empowerment that that we're talking about.
Mahavatar Babaji.
Exactly. He's probably the most well-known example.
This is so clear. Thank you so much, Sally.
Oh, thank you for the question. We got to talk about siddhas. So, Deb?
Okay. Yeah, we have some more questions here from the webcast people. So Carrie says she's studied the Wisdom Goddess with you, all of them. And can you explain the relationship between Chitti Shakti and Kundalini?
Oh, great question. Kundalini is Chitti Shakti in what we could call her individualized personal form in the human body. And one of the things that I tried to convey in the Wisdom Goddess class, which I think many of you took, the Wisdom Goddess 2, and in the classes I've given on Kundalini Shakti, the seven-part class we did, I think it was last year or 2016, was the idea that your Kundalini is not a biological force, as many people believe, but is actually a very profound form of Chitti Shakti herself. So Kundalini is often described as Chitti Kundalini, the coiled form of Chitti Shakti embedded in the human subtle body as the life force which powers our experience of life, but also as the power which at some point in our history, in our destiny, in our lifetimes, is going to start operating as the capacity to experience the truth about the self and the truth about the world, and the fact that the truth that everything that exists in this universe and all other universes is actually within you. So Kundalini is the aspect of Chitti Shakti who operates inside a human being to awaken our consciousness. So, next question.
A Okay, we also have a question from Ruth, or from Shirley, asking, can my heart is the divine heart be translated to Hindi like a mantra, a sacred sound?
Kavita, can you translate my heart is the divine heart into Hindi? My heart is the divine heart is actually a way of saying Shivoham.
Yes.
Or, you know, so, right? So, because heart, Hridaya, is one of the names for Paramashiva. So, and your personal heart, in my experience, the heart, the subtle heart center, but there is a tradition that all of this is inside the physical heart, if the tradition is that inside the heart, you discover the indwelling self, which is Paramashiva, Parashakti. So, aham hridaye. How would you say that? My heart is the divine heart, other than aham Shiva or aham Shakti.
Kavita, I've unmuted you, so.
Okay. Kavita, you can toss your.
Oh,
you're speculating the ring here.
In Hindi, it would be something like "Mera Hriday, Bhagwan ka Hriday,"
Mera
Hriday, Shiva ka Hriday.
Yeah, that's beautiful. My heart, Mera Hriday. Mera means heart.
Mera means mine.
My Hriday means heart.
Yeah, Mera Hriday, Shiv ka Hriday, or Shiv ka Hriday, Mera Hriday. His heart is my heart.
His heart
Shiva's heart is my heart.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
There is a mantra that activates the heart in this way, which goes Om Hridaye Namaha. I am the heart. And in this mantra, you're supposed to understand that by Hridaya you mean the divine heart or the heart that is Shiva's heart, that is the great heart.
Okay. We have another question from Ruth, and she says, thank you so much for the great presentation of the tattvas. She would like to know more about the deep sleep-like state that can happen during meditation. It's happening to her on a regular basis, and it's a bit of a challenge to stay alert while slumping over. Please say more about what is happening in that state, and how does it differ from sleep?
Yes, and I love this question, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to it. The tradition gives many, many ways of understanding the process of the human soul from the so-called ordinary waking state into the state of exalted awareness of presence in deep meditation or with eyes open. And one of the maps that is very useful is the map it's a map from Advaita Vedanta of the four bodies, and there's another map of the five sheaths, but we're doing four bodies here. So, and the four bodies are the body of the physical body, which is called which is the body that we are in the waking state, assuming that we are in our bodies, which is another question. The subtle body, which is the energy body that interpenetrates the physical body, and where thinking takes place, where the tanmatras, remember the subtle elements that we experience in meditation, all the psychic instruments, and also Kundalini Shakti, the chakras, the inner worlds, the inner version of the different realms of the universe are generally considered to be in the subtle body. And so some of you have very, very, very palpable experiences of subtle body. You know, you may see deities, or you may see the chakras, or you may experience the chakras in other ways, or have insights or revelations or colors that clearly come from a deeper realm. And then there is this moment which happens in meditation at some point, pretty much to everybody, where you pass through the subtle body and enter into this state of void, which is in the four body system, it's called the causal body. And it's called the causal body for a number of reasons, and there are different teachings about it, different traditions about it. But one of the teachings about the causal body is, first of all, it's a dark state. It's a state that we enter in deep sleep when we move past the dream state and go into the state of very deep rest called deep sleep. And in that state of deep sleep, we're, first of all, as close to the light of the transcendent self as we generally get in normal consciousness. But we're inside the veil of darkness, the veil of Maya. So when you go into that deep, dark state, what's happening is that you are traveling through the aspect of your inner being that is Maya Tattva within you. And what I want to say about Maya Tattva, because we very often think that deep dark state is something wrong. Maya Tattva is a very, very high subtle state. Maya Tattva is the place where the samskaras, the impressions, the thought forms, the subtle conditioning that operates to form our body mind. It's in Maya Tattva and in the causal body that all of these states and these experiences live. They are lodged, and in the Kundalini tradition, and this is what is significant in terms of our daily experience and our meditation experience. In the Kundalini tradition, as Kundalini Shakti, the power of Chitti's power of awakening, which is operating in every single one of us at this time in our lives, when Kundalini Shakti begins to work inside the system, she does a lot of purificatory work that we experience in the physical body, that we experience in our subtle body as, purification of mind and emotions and purification of the whole of what in neuroscience they call the default mode network, the mental log that for most of us is completely overwhelming in ordinary life, and which the Kundalini starts to clear out. And one of the ways she does this very powerfully is to, as it were, put us into a state that feels like sleep, that's like going out, that's like a kind of unconsciousness, in which the mind is put to sleep, and very, very subtle work goes on where you're disentangled from those conditionings and those forms of conditioning, those samskaras, the vasanas. The vasana means fragrance, and it refers to the tendencies that we've all carried throughout lifetimes. These all have to be dismantled, and that's what's happening when we go into this dark state. Now, the thing is, often when we go into that state, we end up slumping. Sometimes I used to, in my early days of meditation, I would often find myself, I'd be sitting on the floor and my body would bend forward from the waist and my forehead would be on the floor, which I know some of you experience. And I would be in meditation. It would be quite a deep meditation. Then at a certain point, I would wake up from it and, bring my body back to a sitting position. But what I found when I was really meditating in that, that state of, let's call it unconsciousness, that the causal body darkness, as opposed to having fallen asleep, is that I would come out of it, and there would usually be a sense of having been refreshed, of having been somewhere. It wouldn't be logy. in the way that, you know, it often is when we sleep, when we go, you know, when we're sleeping in meditation, and when you're really sleeping in meditation, often what you're doing is kind of, there's a rumination going on. The deep darkness of the causal state is, there's pretty much nothing going on. You maybe hear what I'm saying if this is happening in class, but almost from a distance because you're sort of overwhelmed by the Shakti, which has literally put you deep inside. So that's the, that's let's call it the, that, let's just call it the void meditation experience. And there's another experience which often has to do with having to pass through, actually having to get knocked out because our minds have been so busy and our bodies have been so active and our lives are so, so full of stress and distraction and just the normal surus of daily life, that we are in need of very, very deep rest. And so when we come into meditation out of a very busy life, very often our initial months and sometimes years of meditation will take us, when we first sit, once the thoughts have started to die down, we'll be kind of pushed into this sleep-like state. And sometimes we have to spend quite a long time meditating in that state as the samskaras get cleared out. And then gradually, over time, you begin to emerge from it into the state of the self, the state that's in the tradition called Turiya, which literally means the fourth state, the state that's beyond waking, dream, and deep sleep. And in some traditions, there's a teaching that when you enter deep sleep consciously with some lucidity, that this is a state of realization. In the tantric tradition, it's more of a state of very important and significant and necessary purification that will lead you into being open and ready for the experience of yourself as light, as illumination. So I hope that starts to answer the question. I'm going to tell you a story from a friend of mine shared years ago. He was in an ashram in India, and he was going into that state you describe every morning and was quite frustrated by it. And so he decided that he would drink coffee before he sat for meditation, which if you want to be more alert is not a bad idea. You can keep yourself awake with caffeine for a period of time. So he activated himself with caffeine, and then as he was sitting quite alert, he started to hear a voice inside, and he said, "What are you?" And the voice said, it was a female voice, like the voice of Shakti, "What are you doing awake? This is the time when I put you out so that I can do the deep work in your consciousness." That's I would say, a very beautiful way of looking at this sleep state. And yes, it can be frustrating. And, you know, you might, especially if you're trying to take in information or follow a particular protocol, have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee before you sit for meditation. But at the same time, there's something very, very important and profound about letting yourself be in that unconscious state, letting yourself go through it until the Shakti herself brings you through it. And if you sit for a longer period of time, usually half an hour or 45 minutes, you will naturally come out of that state. You'll kind of wake up in meditation. Because the work of clearing out the samskaric backpack has been done for the day, and then your meditation can become more, let's say, classically or conventionally alert or awake. And actually, there is a chapter on this in my meditation book if you want to if you want to read about it in a in a sort of systematic way. It's in, I think, the 9th chapter of Meditation for the Love of It explains this. So, Deb?
Okay. I'm going to unmute someone that's in North Carolina.
Hi, this is Gail.
Hi, Gail.
Hi. I wanted to just share and maybe have you talk about it too. I've been playing with included versus excluded and the field. And when I go to a Unity church and the minister talked about, she talked about this kindergarten that has started this "you don't say you can't play" movement.
Huh.
And to me, it was just really struck me as wow, because they
beautiful.
Talked about how, how the whole kindergarten class and then every grade after that started coming into this place of including everyone. And so that really struck home with me. And so when I went to my book club, I went, first of all, just, playing with the feeling of being in the field and really feeling that, and I just noticed such a difference in including, really starting to think in terms of in that field, I'm including everyone.
So
and,
beautiful, Gail. Yeah.
It makes such a difference. It's like I had a totally different experience in the book club. And I'm just finding in my life, when I think of it like that, when I think of I'm in the field and I'm including everyone. And I just thought, wow, what if we could teach everyone, every kindergarten had that role? Wouldn't that just be awesome? I mean, that everyone is included. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just thank you, because the teachings and how they affect my life, how they actually play out in my life are just huge. So thank you.
Yeah, these teachings they're so transformative. I can't remember if I told this story in class. It's on this same theme. And it's a story about King Akbar, the famous Mughal emperor, and his prime minister, Birbal, and there's a whole lot of stories in India about these two beings, Birbal being sort of Akbar's teacher in a way, as well as his prime minister. So Akbar says, "Who's greater, me or God?" And Birbal says, "Oh, your majesty, you're much greater than God, because if you don't like someone, you can throw them out of your kingdom, but God can't throw anybody out of their kingdom, out of his kingdom." So it's kind of that. That recognition, everyone is included, always. So thank you, that's beautiful.
Okay, so our next one is, I believe, in Ontario.
Yes, hi.
Okay, St. Catherine's Toroas. How do you pronounce that? St. Catherine's...
Ontario?
Yes, St. Catherine's Tarold, Ontario, yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes. What's your first name? We just have your last name and initial.
Oh, I'm Trish.
Oh, Trish, hi.
Hi. Hi, Sally. I'm so enjoying your course, and I wanted to say it's been so incredibly sort of revealing and on a deeper level. I saw you, I guess about 8.5 years ago, at a workshop at Kripalu, and this is the first time I ever back then heard of these sutras, but I didn't know much, and it was such a different experience sort of coming into it not knowing a lot. And then after that course, I've gotten all your books, read them all, and gotten a lot of the CDs, and just, I think it was last year, got the Vijnana Bhava, your CDs, the Doorways into the Infinite, and so then now coming to this now, it's just on such a deeper level, such a different way, and particularly in the meditations and listening to your voice, When I did on the CDs, it was quite powerful, but hearing it as a live transmission, even though it's over the phone, it's just been, I don't know, just so spectacular, so deep. And some of the things that have been going on, when we're doing that dissolving meditation into the elements, and this has been happening when I was using that infinite doorways, but it's on a deeper level now. The vibration, like the physical, my body starting to shake, and it's like a huge, very deep inside shivering. And I just wondered, is it just blockages being in the different chakras being opened? It's like my body starts shaking for, you know, a moment, and then, you know, at different levels of, you know, and higher up kind of thing.
Yes, yes. And that shaking is, it's like, it's kind of your body shakes and loosens the contraction.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of somatic work these days uses rocking and, you know, having you move in certain ways because it sort of opens up the space that's been constricted by your breath or trauma or, you know, the many other ways in which we constrict our bodies. That shaking they're manifestations of Kundalini Shakti working in both the subtle and physical bodies, and they are, as you say, it is literally, what is happening is that Kundalini is literally freeing the chakras, which as we inferred, as we started to say last week, the chakras are the kind of expression in our system of the teaching as here, so elsewhere, as above, so below, the universe is inside the body in a contracted form. The chakras, as they start to open, they reveal to you the fact that they are actually operating on all the levels of your consciousness. And so that's a kind of a physical, subtle manifestation of it. And I wanted to speak to what you said about understanding all this on a deeper level, because you're absolutely right. These teachings all augment each other. You know, the Vijnana Bhairava is based on the understanding that we've been talking about of the absolute creative non-duality of Chitti Shakti, of the tattvas, because the dialogue of the Vijnana Bhairava, one of the reasons it's considered so authoritative is because it's said to be an expression of the teachings about human awakening that are given at the level of Sadashiva Tattva, at a very high level of expression. And when they come to us, they carry that empowerment, you know, as the Tibetans say, they carry that Shakti of, so to speak, this is what God wants you to know about 112 methods for opening your consciousness to the truth. And, you know, the other thing that I have found completely crucial about studying the Pratyabhignathardayam and the other texts of the Shaiva Tantras is that they explain the truth about Kundalini. And, you know, Kundalini is such a major force in the lives of people like us who are awakening and being guided from within through the activity of Kundalini. When we understand that the energy that's working to open your chakras or dispel illness from your body, et cetera, that it is Chitti Shakti. It's the creative, sustaining, dissolving, concealing, grace-bestowing power of at the heart of the universe, which is activated in you and begins to work in you as Kundalini. Then it starts to help us realize what an incredibly sacred journey we have. You know, we are privileged to have had opened up and awakened for us. That a journey that will eventually allow us to really see the absolute congruity between our physical life and the life of the divine.
Yeah. In your dissolving meditation, the very last line, because you read from your guru, Swami Muktananda. And the very last line of it, you said, regarding everything as part of herself, she remains in tranquility. And when you said that line live, and when I practiced the meditation on the recording that you gave to everyone, it's like, wow, it's like a lightning bolt, you know? Because it just, the part reading into it too, but then just coming with that line at the end, it's like everything, so the fears, the everything, the thoughts, it's like, you know, even that's all part of herself and she remains in touch. It was like, just like lightning.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And that passage, the whole passage, especially that, I think that passage is, it's one of the most powerful expressions of where it is that we're going.
Yeah.
If you respond to it, which I do also, I love that passage. It's to hold that passage, to contemplate it, you know, is incredibly powerful. It's like, it's a kind of a mantra. It's like Chitti Swatantra Vishva Siddhi Hituhu. It's a mantra that if you just hold it in awareness, it sort of comes into your understanding at all sorts of unexpected times. And as you say, it helps you recognize that whatever is arising in her and arising in you,
yes,
in your consciousness.
Yes.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to keep to my original promise, and it's actually not, we actually went over. We went 12 minutes over. So let's keep this succinct. It's Sunday evening, and many of you have things to do. But we will have this, we will have a Q&A every week for the next 5 weeks or, you know, for the rest of the course. So we'll keep doing this and keep discussing the granularity of some of the things that you guys are bringing up, which I so appreciate having the opportunity to talk about with you. So let's bring our hands into Anjali Mudra and place them in front of the heart. And we can end with one very, very interior om, feeling that om is being sounded from the heart, in the heart. Om. I'm going to do it two more times. Om. Om. Thank you so much, guys, for getting on this call with all of us, and have a beautiful next few days. We'll talk some more on Wednesday. Much, much love to all of you. Have a great night, and thank you, Deb. Namaste.